now. Okay, good. I thought I set that up automatically, but I am clearly technology challenged. So, one, two, I guess we should start at the beginning. Share my screen and start the PowerPoint. All right. Let's start with some words of wisdom again. I was reading a piece by Flower Darby that I put in the resources this week, and she said, this past spring, more than a few faculty members new to remote teaching reported feeling discouraged and disconnected from their students. Does that resonate with anybody? The solution, she says, is to reach out to your students more frequently this fall. And speaking to that point, she quotes Harriet Schwartz, to the degree that we can communicate with our students that they matter, we are likely to receive the same messages in return. Compassion stirs compassion, it begets gratitude. When we can connect with students' basic humanity, we are likely to be renewed in our own. All right. I wanted to remind you of the website again, and particularly the resources and questions. Let's jump over there. Some of you have gotten with the program and posted some resources. Let's see what's there. We have enhancing discussions in the asynchronous online classroom. That's a journal article that Alex Dunn put up, which is wonderful. There's another one, Dave Henderson, relevant articles about online education, MOOCs, and the effects of COVID-19. That one doesn't sound as exciting. Exciting in the sense, it sounds more depressing to me, and I have to admit I haven't read them yet, but we'll get there. All right, also the questions. There's some good questions that have come up here. Here's one for you, Dave. What is Slack and how do you use it? Is it integrated in Canvas? Is this something that most students already know about? I guess now we need to figure out a way to post answers to these questions. And then Alan Dean asks the question, how do or can we upload a PDF to the resources page? That's a good question. So anyway, do look at these things and hopefully you'll find them interesting and continue to post this stuff. All right, now let's go back to our PowerPoint. All right.
Steve, while you're doing that, the quotation that you put up a few minutes ago on the first slide reminded me, Robert Wells and I attended a COPLAC thing last week or the week before, I don't remember now when it was, that one. And most of the people we were, it was a music specific COPLAC session. Most of the other faculty.
Does everybody know what COPLAC is? Anybody?
Consortium of Public Liberal Arts Colleges, I think, something like that.
It's schools like ours around North America. There's at least one Canadian school, So go on, sorry to interrupt.
And they have, they have a summer institute and the discipline rotates through. This was the first time they did music. So Chris Ryder and Robert Wells and I all attended virtually. It would be at UNC Asheville. And so I don't know what the discipline is next summer. But most of the faculty we were with were applied music faculty, so teaching lessons. And they, a number of them commented that while their institution, their institutions felt that the pivot online had gone very well for the students, that as they had weekly contact one-on-one with the students, they felt like they had a better sense of how things went, and the students were generally feeling lost. Robert, you can interject here if I'm not getting this right. Now, it seems to me we did better than our peer institutions from looking at the information that was submitted. But still, I suspect that without that one-on-one contact like this that our applied faculty are getting as a matter of course, we don't really know how the students are doing. And it occurred to me, I need to make more of an effort to get students to reach out to me because I don't want to be stalking them. Already it's hard for me to get a student to come into my office. I'm apparently naturally intimidating, but just to get, it's going to be harder for me to do that when I can't see them in class in the same way. So I like the quotation there.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. One of the things that I know from teaching online is that it is easier for students to hide and to drop out. In a classroom situation, if students show up and say nothing, we assume they're there. But online, they could be showing up and doing nothing, but we don't see them, we don't hear them necessarily. So very good point. When in doubt, reach out. I just made that up.
Okay. I have a comment about that.
Sure.
When they show up in Zoom or in teleconference like that, and they don't show their faces, it's equivalent to that because you don't get immediate feedback, facial expression feedback, mm-hmm. if they're Absolutely. Getting anything, or you don't even know if they're there, right? And they could be, I don't know, off playing video games, not even in the room. So that's, and I don't know if I can force them to put on the camera if they even have a webcam with them to get a sense of at least some visual gesture cues that they're with me if I'm working synchronously.
I think that's a good point. I don't think we can force them. I don't think we should force them. But what I do is tell them why I want to see their faces. Tell them that it's hard enough online to tell if they're getting what I'm saying. But at least if I see their faces, I can read some body language, and that's why it's important. And then I just let them decide. One interesting thing, this summer I'm teaching and I have nearly 100% attendance in my synchronous sessions, which is much better than I do during the school year. So I don't know if this is a new thing or what, but anyway.
I can add one thing that sometimes people have bandwidth issues. And if they shift off the video, then they're able to hear and participate more. So it's not always they don't want to be there. So
No.
That's something to keep in mind too.
Yes, absolutely. And I totally, it comes down at one level to trusting your students. And I think that explaining to them why I want to see them is part of that. And then counting on them to be responsible, because we really can't force them. So,
yeah.
But these are all good points.
To Mindy? Chime in, my more lecture-centric class in the spring, when I did do synchronous meetings, had most of the videos shut off. Occasionally a student would turn it on if they were asking a direct question, but otherwise they'd be off. My class that kept meeting synchronously, because it was a seminar that was fully discussion-based and the students were facilitating discussion, there, the norm, and I didn't even set it, it just kind of started there. The mm-hmm. norm was that they would keep their video on unless they were having bandwidth issues. Sure. And the students who were having bandwidth issues would usually throw up in the chat, I'm having trouble, I'm gonna mute my video, or they would just unmute themselves when they asked a question. So they were kind of doing that for themselves because the whole class centered around them interacting with each other, mm-hmm. not me interacting with them as individuals. And so that's also part of it. The more interactive it is, the more they rely on the limited, admittedly, but the visual cues from their peers. When it's just you, they don't need to see anyone else's video. They just need to see you. Yeah, so that also makes a difference.
That'd be interesting. I hadn't thought about that before. Anybody else? All right. Next is, we finally have a schedule for the rest of the summer. Here is the tentative plan. And I particularly want to call your attention to July 29, show and tell. What are you planning for the fall? So I'll be looking for volunteers. who want to spend a few minutes explaining something that they've that they're going to try differently. I think that'll be a lot of fun. All right.
By the way, I think the July 25th is supposed to be July 22nd because the 25th is a Saturday. Yeah,
you're right. Thank you. I have a problem with dates. Ever since middle school, I've had a problem with dates. All right. Oh, sorry, went too far. Okay, so today what we're going to talk about is the role of lecture in online teaching and learning. If you were at the Refocus meeting on Monday, you may have seen Shannon explain in detail how to use Screencast-O-Matic. So we're not really going to focus on the tools and technologies. We're going to talk more about the pedagogy today. I'm sure Shannon, and I can say this, not having reached out to her, I'm sure that she would be happy to help you with Screencast-O-Matic if you have questions. I know I certainly do. Okay, so what I'm going to say today may rub you the wrong way, at least some of you, but I hope you'll keep an open mind. First, I'm going to tell you why you shouldn't use lecture in online teaching. Then I'm going to tell you how and why I do it. It all starts from the question of learning outcomes. What do you want your students to know and be able to do? And so I want you to think about how will lecture get them to there. So, to the extent that you use lecture, what is your purpose? Why do you lecture? Just to pick on Randy again, in an earlier meeting, he said, this is a paraphrase, and I hope I get it right. My students can't learn adequately from the book. They need my lecture to help them learn. Okay, so Randy, is that a reasonable paraphrase of your thinking?
Yeah, it's reasonable.
Okay, good. So my first question is, why not? Why can't students learn adequately from the text? What do you do differently when you lecture than what the text does?
Is that rhetorical, or do you want me to actually answer it?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
It is both.
The simple answer is the major difference is the ability to ask questions. When they hit a roadblock in a textbook, they have no ability to answer a question. So when they're looking at it, they're like, I don't know what that means. Mm-hmm. When they're talking to me, Reef, what does that mean? Boom, answer.
Yes.
Response, move on.
That's a very good answer. Okay, so if you're lecturing primarily for content delivery, are you sure there's not a better way to do it? What's wrong with the book? Do you not like the textbook? Is it great for... Is it an excellent book from the perspective of professors who are teaching out of it, but maybe not so much from the students? You know, do you have low expectations about the ability of students to glean what they need to out of the text? Maybe you just need to find, or even better, write a better textbook. Now that, of course, won't solve the question problem that Randy pointed out. I want to put in a little plug here for digital courseware, which I think offers the potential for a better way. If you're not familiar with digital courseware, it is text. It is a, in lieu of a textbook, you get a kind of a virtual learning environment that includes content and student activities and assessments all rolled into one. It's something that I've been working on for 6 years. And I know that some of you are using it. Certainly, I think Bob Rycroft and Alex Dunn, you guys are using Top Hat, right?
Which yeah, is- and their textbooks have questions like embedded in it, which is really nice. So they read and then they get a question. They read another chunk, get a question, read a chunk, watch a video.
Yep, so. All of those things. And Randy, you mentioned that you guys use Alex or have since recently. So have you seen any positive effect of that in your chemistry students? Or is it too early to say?
Arguably too early to say. I mean, the simple truth is if you, and I haven't done this with more than one section, but obviously if you run a correlation, right, if you basically plot the, like, who does lots of Alex, you plot that versus grade. I mean, you see a correlation, but you can make the argument that that's way too simplified because the good students are the ones who are driven to do the Alex are going to be the same ones that perform well because they're driven to study. So it's a convoluted process. So do we have enough data to say yet? No. But does it show promising, you know, effects? Sure. It does for the ones who do it.
I've been doing, this is maybe off track a little bit. For 2 years now, I've been doing a randomized controlled trial with the courseware that I use. And so I have students in the same classroom who use the courseware and others who don't. And I've been able to show statistically significant positive effects. So that makes me hopeful. But it's strange. Well, I don't know if strange is the right word. It is startling to me that there are very few decent studies out there of how well this stuff works, even though the big commercial publishers are pushing it like crazy. And I do think it has potential. Oh, okay. Anyway, back to work here. So let me tell you where I'm coming from here. No, it's not Alexandria, Virginia, though that's true too. We know from the literature on learning science that for most students, listening to lecture is not the most effective way of learning. We just know that. Okay, I've mentioned the Doer effect before. Some people at Carnegie Mellon did an experiment, and what they found was that students learn 6 times as much from working with the content as they do from just reading the content or listening to a lecture, 6 times as much. Okay. Whoopsie. Oh, yeah, we're past that. Okay, so Herb Simon. I think it's fair to say he was a very bright guy. He won the Turing Medal in computer science and the Nobel Prize in economics. And then later in his career, he got very interested in cognitive science. And what he said is, learning results from what the student does and thinks and only from what the student does and thinks. And then he goes on to say, the teacher can advance learning only by influencing what the student does to learn. Okay, we can't pour it into their heads. Here's a line that I've used before. This is actually directed to Dave Henderson. People in the context of debating, you know, in-class learning versus online learning. So I've asked the question, where does learning take place? What's the answer?
You asking me?
I am. I'm asking anybody.
Oh, okay.
Where does learning take place? In the classroom or online, or where does learning take place?
Well, it can be both. I mean, I think it can be both. I don't think it's either or. I think it's with the student.
My answer is learning takes place in the student's brain. So we need to remember that. It's not necessarily in the classroom. It's not necessarily in the cloud. You know, if good teaching makes students think and makes students, makes students think. We can just stop with that point. Okay. So I was talking to David Wiley over the weekend. David Wiley is a cognitive scientist. And what he said is the key difference is which direction information is flowing. Everything that flows into the student is less effective in terms of learning than the things that flow out of the student. Grant Wiggins said, it's not teaching that causes learning. It's attempts by the learner to perform causing learning, dependent on the feedback and the opportunities to use it. And that's an important point as well. The doer effect is so powerful because in that experiment, in addition to practice, the students got immediate feedback on what they did. So if you're wrong on a question, the feedback you get actively corrects your misunderstandings. Okay. Prompt feedback is really important. And I think that we don't necessarily do as good a job at that as we could. Okay. So here's the big question. How can these findings from the literature inform our practice of lecturing? I think the answer begins again with remembering your learning objectives. What are you trying to accomplish? Okay, here's something that I do. I limit lecture to the hard parts of the content, okay? Through experience and regular assessment, I know what parts of my course students struggle with. One of the things that I do is I give students credit for telling me what parts of the chapter they don't understand. So by Sunday night, they have to send me a little email and say, here are the things I don't get. Okay, and then I sort and collate that list and I know what areas the students are struggling with, and then I spend my either limited class time or limited lecture time online just talking about those things. And typically I do this in the form of mini lectures that don't last more than 10 minutes. Also, it's a great way to get students to read the book before class. And it works. And I tell the students, these are the easiest points you're gonna get in this course. You just have to tell me what you don't understand. Okay, so who used some form of lecture last spring? What did you do? Yeah, Mindy, go ahead.
Well, I don't think I made particularly great use of it. You know, we had 48 hours to turn around, and I was trying to keep my classes as stable as possible since they were in the middle of projects. I did video lectures. I normally do a very interactive style, lots of discussion and activities mixed in. So my 50-minute class ended up being 25 to 30 minutes on video with me filling in more of those gaps that we would normally have with discussion. It was too long. It wasn't particularly interesting. The students who were watching them liked that I was showing my face through parts of it, that I was using a blank PowerPoint slide as a virtual whiteboard so I could do stuff live for them and kind of mimic what I would do in the classroom. So it wasn't that I'd suddenly switched to jazzy PowerPoint slides, which was not my style. But it was definitely stopgap. It wasn't great pedagogy. It was getting through.
Somebody else? I see a lot of people nodding. I certainly agree with that.
Yeah, I can also say that like Mindy, I kind of wanted to keep the class as similar as it was in the in-person format. And I basically went over the slideshows that the slideshows that were already uploaded, and I just sort of went over the lecture, and then I just pivoted to the activity, which is in my case usually lab exercises to analyze satellite imagery, but the lecture part, I basically used the 40-minute time limit that Zoom gives you to sort of just cut it there and not go beyond that. And that is a problem in my format of classes because it's a nightly class of 3.5 hours, which even in person was difficult to manage people's attention. But in an online setting, it was impossible to have a three and a half hour live session. So I just cut it to 40 minutes of lecture slides, explanation of what was in the website in Canvas for the next assignment, and then just get quick feedback on questions, and that was it. And then I just told them, see you for Q&A sort of discussion board. I'll be on Canvas chat these times, and then just we met next week. That was it.
Do you have any sense of how well it worked?
I got limited feedback from the evaluations we got last semester. I think they liked that I kept the pace of the class with synchronous thing. I think that some of them didn't get too much of the lecture about the lecture, but because the slides were already there. But in keeping the class in a structure that we all were in the same page for each week, I thought that was necessary. So the lecture was an excuse to sort of just touch base. I have exams and labs. So the content of the lectures was the main themes and topics that they would cover in the sort of Canvas-based multiple choice exam. Beyond that, I really don't know.
I kind of used making videos and lectures as an opportunity for when we get back to face-to-face. So at first I wasn't gonna do any video lectures at all. I was just gonna see kind of what happened, because I've taught online classes before without video lectures and it went fine. And then I said to myself, well, you're home, you can make these videos. So I made the videos, and what I'm actually planning to do when we get back face to face is actually try to flip my classroom. So I'm using it as an opportunity that I'll have the videos, and so they can watch the videos and use that as a resource when they need it. And they can go back to the video when they need it, or if they're studying, they can have that. And then when we're in class, we can have more opportunities to get to some like activities that I don't always get to because we're talking about things rather than doing things. So that's how I'm kind of viewing these video lectures, I would say.
So there's a silver lining there.
That's what I told myself.
Yeah, keep repeating that over and over. Christine, you did something interesting. Can you talk about it?
Sure. I lectured, I have taught online before a while ago, and there was a lot of concern about bandwidth with video lecturing, and frankly, I talk about buildings, so I wasn't really sure how much they needed to see me. I cut each of my lectures in half to just about 20 minutes, and then I did a voice memo that they could play either with the as they paged through the images from my PowerPoint, or just listen to it. And so I try to construct them so that there was a lot of visual imagery as I talked about the buildings, and then asked them to, you know, kind of look at things online and that kind of stuff. And then what I did was I used the online chat to have them, it's the kind of stuff that I would have done in class as discussion, and honestly, it's only the few really enthusiastic students who would participate when I did this online or in person, but online I would ask them to compare and contrast some very different styles or some very different concepts, and get them kind of discussing those bigger ideas online. So that's how I use lecture to, in this class anyway, to really point their to refine their skills of looking, because it's all about analyzing buildings in a visual way and understanding the cultural meanings of them. So I kind of point out lots of examples visually and how it's applied differently in different examples. So I use lecture to help them kind of apply, at least with the pictures that I give them, what they do. And then ultimately how we test them in this is I give them pictures and I say, I can't guarantee these aren't buildings you've never seen before, but I can guarantee I've never shown them to you in class and they're not in the books. So now you analyze them. So that's how they're tested on the knowledge. So I try to do that in the lectures, kind of on a small scale.
One of the things that intrigued me about what you do is that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you gave them the option of audio only. Mm-hmm. So do you have a sense of how many of your students used one versus the other and what they thought about those?
Yeah, so it wasn't one of the specific questions in our feedback, but I did have a number of students. I kind of asked them in the chat, kind of how it was going and what they thought. So it was not any kind of representative example, but I can tell you that a number of the students that did respond said that they appreciated having just the audio because they could listen to that several times without having to rewatch the slides, and they could also look at the slides at their own pace, right? Without me talking, they could just kind of page through them again to kind of look at them. So it gave them the opportunity to have kind of smaller file sizes rather than a video with me as a talking head, and then they could listen to either part separately. And the ones who responded, most of them liked it. A couple of them said, "Well, I don't understand why you just don't do video." But I would say overwhelmingly, the people who responded anyway said that they liked having the opportunity to do one or the other or both at the same time. And they could, one of them said that they listened to it like they listened to podcasts. So they would do the dishes and re-listen to my lectures, which good or bad, I don't know, but they seem to learn it well. So
I think that's good.
So I help with dishes.
So there are two things that struck me from what you just said. One is that when we make recordings, students can view or listen to the recordings multiple times, as opposed to, just sitting in your classroom, the lecture goes, and however good or bad you think it went, there's no real record of it except for their notes, maybe. And yeah. So that's certainly an advantage of kind of online format or any format where there's lecture capture. The other thing that struck me about what you just said that I only got just now was I thought that students would do either or, and you suggest that some of the students did both in different contexts. That's really cool.
Yeah, it gave them choice, kind of what helped them most, I thought.
Yeah, can I yes. chime in? Jump. Yeah, as much as in DLS we've been talking about screen capture and video, like if I were teaching, I would probably actually do an audio, I would disaggregate probably my visuals from, because I'm an audio addict. So I love being able to listen to those things, but also, and I don't know how you address this, because this is something we think about is, so you have, one of the reasons we have pushed video stuff is that captioning feature within, because there's this expectation you should be making these things accessible. And audio, there's not necessarily an equivalent of that, although you could upload to YouTube and do all that. But as I've been making content, what I discovered is I will script something entirely out before I record it, because I just need to have that. So if you're, this is my process. If you're already going through the process of writing it, maybe you should also just make that available to your students, because that is yet another format that they can engage with it. There could be a reason that they're like, I know it was I can't remember what that word is, but if I open this document, I could search that really quickly and then get back to that as just yet another way. It's not just making it accessible, but providing students with different avenues to intersect with the things that you're giving them. So that
would be mine. Thank you, Shannon. Yeah, that's a good point. I actually provided them. I don't write word for word, but I provide them with my outline. So it has all of the keywords and everything else. So I had wanted to do transcripts, but I honestly just didn't have time last semester, but giving them the outline I thought was good. And that's, I forgot. So
yes, those things. Yeah. Any way you get, the written word, like all these things you're doing to give students time to sit with something. Video can be great. I love video, but like, if you want students to really think about something, giving them space to pause, which is hard to do in video. Our instinct is to watch a video and not pause, but you can pause when you're reading, Anyway, sorry.
Or we could ask them, in our presentation, we could say, okay, here's a question, pause the video and think about it before you come back. You know, that's a possibility I just thought of. Elizabeth?
Go ahead.
Go on.
I was just going to say, I really love the idea of having the audio only as an option. I hadn't thought about doing that. But it fits really well in my workflow. What I've been doing is that I'm not using Screencast-O-Matic. I'm recording any of the video lectures in Zoom. And the reason I'm doing that is that I do it on PowerPoint, and the live captioning on PowerPoint I find to be very, very effective. I think it works really well. It even includes a lot of, some grammatically correct structure. It'll show punctuation for most of it. I have to remind myself to make sure I'm speaking clearly and slowly enough, but I go to pretty good clip and it picks it up really well. So I'm using that even for synchronous meetings. I'll just put a PowerPoint slide up with a couple of points, and then I leave plenty of space at the bottom for the captioning to show up, and then I record it. And the reason I wanted to mention here is that not only is that working really well for recording the lectures, I like it. It's working better than the auto captioning in YouTube. And it's probably almost as good as Google Meet's auto captioning, but it's really quite good and I like it. But then if you record it in Zoom, and especially if you're doing it in the cloud, which everybody has an enterprise license, you'll be able to do this. When you download it from Zoom, it'll download both the video file and the audio file. So then you could just post both of them very easily in Canvas, or you don't want to post them both in Canvas, but put the audio file maybe in Canvas, but the video file on YouTube, and that way they can access both of them. The other thing I like about putting the video on YouTube unlisted is then they can control the bandwidth. They can control the audio, the video quality, so that if they have really low bandwidth, they can just watch it at 144p or something instead of 720, and they can play around with it in different ways. But if I don't want to add a lot of steps where I'm then processing it one way, then processing it another, but doing it in Zoom, it'll give you the video and the audio as separate files automatically, and it wouldn't take much time to be able to make both available. I hadn't done that before, but I think I'm going to start. I like that suggestion.
I do want to jump in here real quick, because I mean there are what Anand describes is an interesting workflow, but it's not exactly the same as captions because you can't edit them. So if things aren't caught or things like that, while this could work, and it's certainly great to use if you're doing anything live, I'm not sure, and I'm not the ODR expert here, but I would like to have them like evaluate what you're doing there to see if that, like if that's a good workflow, then lots of people should know about that workflow. But I know that when I use some of that stuff, the scientific names get messed up, or there's just stuff in live captioning that doesn't always equal. So as far as like thinking that that's a process that means you do not have to caption, I'm not sure that that's equivalent. And if you have captions running on your videos and then you want to recaption them, it could get to be quite interesting to try and have to do that, and visually can start get challenging on the screen. So yeah, but that's a cool process you're working on there, and I'd like to see if I can follow up on there. But I just wanted, before everybody decides to do that, just wanted to say something that we might need to just check that that's good. Also, one other thing that you have as a setting inside of Zoom is also, if you record to the cloud, it will record a transcript for you. Ooh. So it creates a transcript file that then you could then upload to like YouTube or things like that. But then you could also, I was able to do this, played around with this a few days ago. You can also open it inside of Word, and it will open up as a Word document then. And then you can save it as a Word document, and it has the timestamps on it too. Also, if you had multiple people in a Zoom meeting, it also puts their name in front of what they said. So it has their name and timestamp. So there's lots of different ways to get after these kinds of things, and the multiple modes that are right there in Zoom, as Alan points out, are really great assets.
Jerry, thanks for that. I wanted to ask a follow-up regarding that last function that you were talking about. If you can get that transcript of the meeting, can you import that as a file in YouTube, for instance, for captioning?
You can.
And then that'll fit with the time code?
Yeah. Yep. You know, you'll still, like many things, have to still edit it. So what I don't know is if it's any better than what YouTube would do. So I haven't checked that, but as far as like a way to have a transcript, like this other thing we're talking about here, you know, ways for people to have different ways to get to the content, it's just another option that you have. Now you have to go into your personal settings in Zoom and turn that feature on because it's not there by default. And I also noticed if I record locally, it does not work that way. It has to be recorded to the cloud.
Yeah, the cloud is what it's being able to generate that. So, and I just want to note with Zoom cloud recordings, you'll all with a license be able to do that, but we have limited space. So just know that it's like, don't depend on storing things there long-term. Like you want it to do its thing, take it down and you need to stick it someplace else. This is what we've already been experiencing where don't rely on it as a place of storage for long-term things.
This is a wonderful conversation and I'm struck by how different our perception of teaching is today than what I was trained for in graduate school. I don't know if that's just a function of my age or if it's a more general statement. But anyway, Elizabeth, I wanted to ask you, you do something similar to what Christine does. Is that correct?
Yes, I did in the spring. I didn't do them with every unit, but I did short, like 5 to 10 minute lecture videos, mostly for applied. Sorry, my kids are in the room, so I'm a little distracted. but yes, mostly for applied activities and just kind of walking them through. This is for example, it was in research methods, we were talking about some of the statistical tests and we were moved online right as we were getting ready to learn how to use SPSS. So I kind of just walked them through doing things in like Google spreadsheets so we could still learn learn how to actually run the tests and what they mean. So while the text was helpful with that, it wasn't going to give them the hands-on experience and they needed to see me actually run through it and do it and provide examples very specific to some of the projects they were working on. So I tried to keep it to like 5 to 10 minutes per lecture just so I didn't lose their complete attention. And then we did like, we had optional Q&A Zoom hours.
Thank you. Anybody else?
Steve, I was gonna say, I use lecture notes that I print out and then I use a document camera. And then I narrate, I discuss it, and then each lecture video is up to 15 minutes, and I upload it to YouTube. And so like, I'll have one lecture video, maybe I'm talking about inventory costing, and I call that like overview of inventory costing, and I'm talking more about the theory, why do we do FIFO, LIFO, weighted average stuff. And then in the second lecture video, I'll talk about, here's a math problem on how we do first in, first out inventory costing. And then I say, pause the lecture video, you do the quick check problems on the next page, and then come back and check it. And then I go on to the next topic. And that's exactly what I do in class. But the difference between the online and the class is during class, I say, okay, work with your friends, work together. And then I immediately give them feedback. So it's I don't think it's quite as good as in class, but it's the best that I can get from what I can see in the online environment. And then I use synchronous sessions to do additional problems and review the homework.
So what is it that you show them with the document camera?
Printed notes.
Okay.
And then you can see me writing on the notes and commenting on the notes. And it's a whole document that I've already assembled that has problems in it and bullet points rather than using PowerPoint.
So are the fonts large enough so that students can actually follow what you're doing?
Yes, it's okay. All font size 16.
All right, because I can't imagine just printing out my normal lecture notes and showing them to students. I don't
know. All font size 16.
Yeah, nice. Thank you. Okay, now, in addition to the sorts of things that we've been talking about before, many of you mentioned some really clever different kinds of things that you do, like, let's see, David Harmon, do you want to talk about polling?
Sorry, sorry, I was doing something else. Well, I would insert these polls at the end of class on my American Foreign Policy class as a way to kind of elicit thinking of the students on particular topics. And some of the questions were short answer, some of them required two paragraphs. And then with the GoToMeeting platform, which is what I was using in lieu of Zoom, it captured that with every session, and then I could send it back out to the students so they could not only see what the other students had said on the polls, but also get a sense of sort of the topic. And I found that it was really interesting because given the opportunity to not just sit and look at me, they're actually doing something, some activity. Over time, they got very creative and their answers improved and their participation improved. And I wouldn't tell them in advance what the poll was, so it was all sort of off the cuff, partly drawn from the readings and partly drawn from current events, and then they had to blend the two together in their answers.
Nice. Now, you do some other things, or you mentioned some other things that you do.
Well, I also embedded historical videos, foreign policy speeches, and others. In the middle of the course lecture. And then we discuss it right afterwards. I did have some difficulty with that in that they couldn't hear it, so they had to actually cut and paste URL and then see it separate and then all come back together in the class. But that kind of broke up. I did that to kind of break up the monotony, so we're not doing the same thing since I met live every class period. But having these little historical vignettes on particular foreign policy concepts, like Kennedy's speech or Eisenhower's speech and these kinds of things really helped. They also use excerpts from panels from think tanks as well. And with some of those would be some of those would be assignments. And that seemed to work out. It seemed to keep their interest, and that was the whole point. Keep attention, keep interest. I don't want them to be bored of me after a while.
You mentioned something that nobody else did, which is you brought in guest speakers, which I think is a fantastic idea.
Yeah, I had several guest speakers, people that I knew that volunteered. They seemed to have time on their hands as well, so it worked out. Especially my Africa class, since it was 2-hour, 45-minute class, that really is a challenge teaching that online. So I had several guest speakers and World Bank. And I opened it up, in fact, to some of the other university, some faculty and other students and other courses who signed on to my course that night, for example. That was really well received by the students because, you know, these are practitioners. And I mean, I was hoping that they would come live to my course, but of course they couldn't because of COVID, but sure. Worked out really well.
I've done that a few times and it's worked out well. And the last time I did it afterwards, and this was in an FSEM, I asked my students why they liked it, having the outside speaker. And one of the students said, well, it was really great to have an expert talk to us.
I might just add, all my courses I teach with a sort of practical bent as a practitioner and spend a lot of time talking about how one would get work in the field using your political science, international affairs degree, some of the things that I've done in my career and some of the public policy areas where you would be useful. And that was appreciated. So the the speakers kind of added to that, and then the students all asked him questions. How do I get a job as an intern at the World Bank? Which he was delighted to answer, and spent about 15 minutes talking about opportunities for students for internships at World Bank, for example.
That sounds great. Bob, could you talk about using synchronous quizzing?
Okay, all right, well, I, like Alex, use Top Hat, and you know, what I would do is I would conduct a synchronous class, and I would share my screen and discuss my PowerPoint slides, but then every few slides I would post Top Hat questions, and students could answer them using their phone or device or whatever they were using, and it kept the class moving in, sort of the same way that it had been prior to the shutdown. So there was a lot of familiarity there, but it's something where students, can't just sort of rest for 50 minutes during a class. They've got to interact with material. And I'm happy I was able to do it that way. And it's really going to continue. But obviously, I don't think I approached the class in quite the way you're talking about today. And what you're talking about today has been really useful to me.
So did you show the results, Bob, or did you just give them the answer?
What you would do is after they answer the question, it will show how many students answered each of the possible answers, how many people responded to each of the possible answers. And you could tell whether they were getting it or not. I mean, you could get a class average, and if they weren't, you could stop and go back and review the material.
Did you give them credit for participating, or did you grade their answers or anything like that?
I would not grade them during the class. However, at the end of each class, I gave what was called an in-class quiz question, and I would grade them on that. And mm-hmm. that was partly an incentive to get them to come to class.
Well, sure.
When it comes to participation, I mean, as long as they were in the class, people were participating and with the PowerPoint questions, they would respond to them. So I didn't have people who just switched off and didn't do anything.
Good. Anybody else want to contribute? These are all great ideas. I'm learning a lot. Well, let me tell you something that I did. Sorry. No, that's not right. Okay. In my intermediate theory course, that was the class last spring that I tried to keep as close to the face-to-face model as I could. And so I moved, what I did online was sort of an interactive lecture style. If you're not familiar with interactive lecture, I put a link to some information about that in the resources bucket. What I do in this class is very analytical, very theory based. So I work through a theory, and then I call on students to do examples in the class. Usually I ask in face-to-face classes, I put them in small groups. And while I didn't do this, in the future, I could easily put them into breakout rooms and ask them to work through problems and then come back and report out. And then at the end of class, I typically would assign a homework that would ask them to do the same sort of problem, but for a grade. So I talked a little bit. I gave them a problem to do as a group. We talked about the result, and then I gave them a follow-up assignment. And that seemed to work pretty well. Okay. I think my next slide is out of order. Okay, so what I did is I went over the homework that you guys turned in, and this is sort of a kind of a taxonomy of things that people said. There was synchronous lecture. There was synchronous lecture and recording for later viewing. There was interactive lecture, recording a lecture for students to view synchronously, sharing lecture slides without commentary, sharing lecture slides with narration, synchronous non-mandatory Q&A sessions. Pam, that was your idea, right? Polling students, synchronous quizzing, and some other great ideas. I put this list down just so when you get the PowerPoint, you'll be able to see what we talked about today. Let's see if we can pull some things together here. No, that's out of order. There we go. So what can we say about the pros and cons of online lecturing, or the cons and pros, depending on which order you want to go in? I can start. Zoom lectures are probably less effective than face-to-face lectures, everything else equal. If you think Zoom meetings are challenging, and we've all been looking at Zoom meetings, imagine how hard it is for a student to stay focused during a 60-minute lecture on Zoom, or even a 45-minute lecture on Zoom. In Zoom lectures, it's harder for faculty to read body language, to adjust what you say on the fly. It's easier for students to check out, especially if they mute their video. And if the lecture is asynchronous, all of these things are probably reinforced. Anybody else? Other cons or some pros?
Steve, it seems like a thing to consider too is the way that we view, and I should point out I'm coming from almost a kind of anti-lecture stance. I was kind of bagging on my two-day teacher training in grad school a little bit ago, but the thing that I do remember them saying was, like, for teaching writing, like, lectures are really the kind of wrong way to go. Like, More of a, here's an idea, now let's work with the idea, discuss each other's use of the idea, and then come back to it. So very little lecture. I'm starting to use kind of more and more short lectures for this, and I'm kind of planning a short, like, 5-minute lecture. My kind of rubric for thinking about it is, if a friend was to send me a video, what's my cutoff time for willingness to watch it, right? And then, because it's a lot easier to watch a bunch of short things. And if you've been binging anything during the quarantine, you know this, right? That there's something about, like, oh, this movie's 2 hours. I'm not watching that. But then you'll watch 6 episodes of something instead. And it's a kind of similar idea with this, that if you kind of break it up and give them moments to process and work with the idea and then come back to it, that can be a lot more effective than just, here's a 60-minute block of me talking.
So short lectures are probably more effective than long lectures. Yeah, I think we can say that. I think we can say that interactive lectures are probably more effective. And the one huge advantage is recorded lectures and slides can be watched more than one time. We heard people talking about that. And honestly, I've discovered that recording takes so little effort that it's hardly worth debating whether we should do it or not. Anybody else? Other thoughts?
Eve, can I ask a question?
Of course.
So we talk a lot about recording lectures, and I, for one, get stuck in the mindset of when I'm recording a lecture, I have to be seated, I'm at my chair, and this is where I am. When I lecture, though, I don't sit down. Mm-hmm. I don't stop moving. I am standing literally on tables, throwing things at people. How do we get that encapsulated online?
Well, remember Michael Wesch did some of that in the video that I showed the other week. And the way he did it is he used his phone to videotape himself so that he could actually move around and jump and stuff like that.
But my students are often my chess pieces. And so I'm feeling this distinct lack of them. So when we talk about 46 chromosomes in the human body, I nicely have 46 students and they each are one and we pair up and we unzip DNA as we're all standing in the middle of Jeff's 100 climbing over tables. And I'm not exactly sure how to replicate that kind of an experience online. And particularly for my tactile students, I have a large number of students that tell me they register for my section of courses because we're going to get up and move around and it's not a stationary process. But this kind of video recording for me feels like it is, particularly if you want to be able to hear me well throughout the entire thing. So I'm just curious how other people do that and how do I get more out of that mindset of I'm sitting at a computer recording. I think the video you referenced from last week is a good start.
I don't have an answer for you, but I think it's a wonderful question. And when I get a question like that, my normal approach is to pan out and think maybe doing it the way, trying to replicate what we do in class literally is maybe not the best way to do it. I'd love to think about this over the summer and see if I can come up with a better answer for you.
Yeah, I'm chiming in. I would love to, some things immediately pop to mind, that April, if we want to brainstorm, but because you, I think, what I love is the physical nature of that. And so you might need to reconsider what those physical things are, but I could imagine that if you're say recording audio, and then you're okay, in order to imagine this, do this. And you were instructing them to do this thing and they're listening. And, I know some of these things work better with a group of people, but you could be okay, now get up and do, X, Y, Z. And that way they could, in their time, if they wanted to, do that. And so they're not with you, but they can get a sense of moving through the physical world. So maybe there's some alternatives, examples that could be done by themselves, which is not as great as a group, but I don't know, I feel like there's lots of interesting things to explore there that I would love to hear people.
Just offered the other day in our other in the Refocus session, introduced some of us to Padlet. And there is an aspect of Padlet that allows you to move, to physically, you're not a person, of course, but you can move images. So you could use that as a classroom space and then, congregate in different areas. So Padlet might be one resource for that.
Thank you.
None of my lectures are recorded at a desk. I'm standing up and moving and I just put my computer on top of.
Yeah, I wanted to say I don't lecture standing still, even in the classroom. I don't get my students to move around to make buildings, but I can't stand still. So when I record my lectures, I actually record them on my phone while I'm looking at the images so that I have that same voice energy of running around the room that I have.
I'm also a pacer. I walk around the room. I get literally thousands of steps during a class period. And I do my best to try to bring some of that energy to when I'm recording, but I have to do it as a performance, right? It's different because I'm not feeding off the room and I don't have the physicality of it. So I have to think about it differently. That said, I don't have a good space to prop my computer up or prop my phone up and record myself as it is to get a reasonable backdrop behind me that's non-distracting, there is one spot in my house I can be in where I both have light and a non-distracting background, and that's it. And I, you know, I'm working in a public space. I'm working in my dining room. It's shared space in my home. In the same way our students have restrictions, so do we. And I think it's important that we recognize that just because someone else has done something successfully with putting a phone on a tripod and having a lapel mic and bouncing around the room and doing things like that doesn't mean that that's realistic for us. We're all in make the best of it, and we can be good teachers not doing stuff the way we would want in a perfect world, right? I can't do a virtual backdrop if I wanted to. My computer won't handle it. I'm using $12 earbuds from Target to have a halfway decent audio quality. It is what it is. I think we have to keep that in mind as well and model that for our students. We're asking them to do presentations and recordings, and sometimes they're in suboptimal conditions, and we just make it work. We do the best we can.
I wonder if it wouldn't help, and I know this is going to sound crazy, if we had help doing these things, like someone to hold the camera while we were doing what we do. You know, just a thought, since we're sort of brainstorming here.
Well, and I've conscripted my colleague slash husband into doing that for me for orientation videos, which mm-hmm. is really helpful. But I don't think he's really going to want to teach my classes with me every day of the semester. I could be wrong, and he can voice his own opinion. But yeah, I mean, I need a little droid that can follow me around and has a good microphone. But Steve, if you're bored, come on by. I will love to conscript you into
something. And certainly after I retire, that's a possibility. So, but no, just brainstorming again, I could imagine using a student aid or something to do this when we're able to get back into campus or something like that. You know, I don't think we as faculty think creatively enough about how to teach. And, you know, if nothing else, the pandemic has made us rethink some of our assumptions about how we do it.
Can I throw one more thing in, April? One of the things that struck me as you were talking that I think I lost getting distracted with another thought was that it wasn't just the physicality, but it's this intense engagement that everyone being in one place allows. Mm-hmm. And so figuring out what things are going to be best in your class in synchronous sessions, even if they're periodic versus asynchronous, might be good. And then you'll have to do it differently. But I've done things like in my social psych class, that's a more traditional 50-minute, 3-day-a-week class, I interrupt class in the middle and I use Socrative.com and I'll do polling. I'll break them into groups and then they have to give me texts and then we do polls about them to see if they can correctly identify what prompt that group was. And then we discuss where there's almost always points of confusion. Okay, why are these two likely very closely confused? What's going on that's making it hard to tell those apart? Or it'll generate word clouds. And this is all free, right? Like I'm not paying for any of this. It's a free account and I can just run it over the internet during a class session. And you can do that during a synchronous online session as well. It's not gonna work as well asynchronously. I can say, okay, pause the video. Okay, think about this. Okay, are you thinking about it? But there's only so much that they're likely to do. I've done some of those workshops. I don't pause the video and stop and do that activity most of the time.
Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to go off script again, since I often do that, and say that I've really enjoyed our meetings together. And the best part of it for me was to learn about all the incredible things that my colleagues are doing that otherwise I never would have heard about, except at the margins. So thank you all for this. Okay, two more things and then we will be done. The first is talking about last week's big homework assignment, which was participating in the online discussion. What did you think of that? Did you learn anything? I know I did. What are your thoughts? I will say, I know I am gonna let you speak. I violated one of my own rules by responding to nearly everybody's posts. And the reason why is I found them all really interesting. That's not always the case with students. You guys were able to go into more depth and to ask more interesting questions than my students often do. Anyway, so what did you think? If you didn't participate, then you're excused from this part of the conversation. But you really should go back and look and see what your colleagues have written.
I'll say one of the things that I got out of looking through, and I don't think I've seen the most recent batch of posts, but one of the things I got out of it is what my students often say they get out of asynchronous discussion is that feeling of, oh, I'm not alone in this. Other people are having the same questions. Other people have the same concerns. And intellectually, I knew that, right? We've been doing this, we're sharing concerns, but at the same time, to see it in writing and to know that we're struggling in similar ways and facing similar challenges in our honestly very different classes, disciplines, classrooms, physical or virtual, is always reassuring, because sometimes it feels like, what am I doing wrong? As opposed to maybe what we're doing collectively is not working the way we want it to.
And just to say something I've said before, I mean, I totally endorse what you said. Online learning by its nature tends to be isolating. So anything that we can do to make you feel part of the community, I think, is a positive thing. Other thoughts? Okay, so here's your homework assignment for next week. Let's see if I can find it correctly. What I want you to do is describe one way to incorporate student activity into your lecture to the extent that you lecture. Many of you already have talked about that, and that's fine, but if you haven't, try to add one thing, that you might try this fall. Okay, and I'll send you information about where you should send this after the meeting. So thank you very much, and I'll see you next week, if not sooner.
Thanks, Steve.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So Steve, I hope you're serious about coming back to help me video in the future.
Of course, yes. Yeah.
I worry a lot about my students who...
Yeah, I've decided to retire this summer.
This summer?
So I'll have time this fall.
Well, I hope you're adjuncting an FSEM this fall, because otherwise you're volunteering your time.
Kidding.
All semester long, buddy.
I know. I just wanted to raise your blood pressure a little bit if I could.
Oh, please. I'm sending out emails. You know my blood pressure's already up.
Yes. No, I actually, I love that idea that you mentioned about your chromosomes. And I'm really intrigued by how you could do that. I bet there's a way. Years ago, DTLT gave a talk on blogging. This was literally years ago, early 2000s. And the dean was invited. That was Rosemary Barra.
Oh my gosh, okay.
Yes. In the Q&A, she stood up and she said, I can't imagine a single academic use for blogging. And then she sat down. And I hadn't really thought about it. I was just going because I wanted to learn more about it. But I took that as a challenge. You know, it's like, there's got to be something here. And of course there is, you know, but she was not sufficiently open-minded to be able to see that.
Well, and I think she's also quite happy that she is now retired.
Okay. Not, yeah. Sure.
Not working through that.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. No. Yeah. I need good ideas. I need people to push me to try to figure out how to, I think Mindy said it best, not recreate, but to get to that same point.
Yes.
So I'm crowdsourcing as much of what other people are trying because I think it's important.
Is it just weird? Feel
inept at doing it.
Is it weird that I'm taking notes from what you guys say?
No, I think that's brilliant. What do you think? I have my note cards.
I don't know.
I wrote down everybody who had something very helpful and things to go look at. So
yes.
No, it's perfect.
And I'm getting the feeling that people are getting something out of this. I know I'm getting a lot out of this, just hearing ideas, hearing other people talk, you know, anyway.
I think there's a lot to digest. I think I have to remember that I need to pick one or two platforms and then stick with those so I can teach them to my students well.
Yes.
And then move on. Now, I say all of this, I'm not actually teaching a remote class, but I think that that's going to be part of instruction, at least for the last few of the semester or so.
But I started using online discussions in the late 1990s as a way of structuring what my students do outside the classroom.
That's brilliant.
And I teamed up with a colleague at Elon, and we would run discussions across our two classes so people would get really different perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to Blackboard.
Okay.
And that closed down the ability to do that.
Oh, dude.
Yes. And so we just stopped. But it was a really fabulous idea. You know, once again, letting the platform limit your pedagogy. Right. So I'm getting some fantastic ideas about my FSIM.
I'm excited. I can't wait to see how you put them all together.
I am too. So thank you.
Okay, well, I'll get out of your hair. Thank you much.
Yep. Judith, are you there? Do you have a question? Judith? All right, I'm going to close things off.